Hello again, everybody. Let's hope the information technology stands up the second time around. So I'm going to explain a little bit about how we try to develop a theory of quantum gravity and why it's difficult. So let's start with particle mechanics, which is something that we're all familiar with. So the typical problem in particle mechanics is you have a mass moving in a potential, and it starts at some place at some time, initial time t0. It starts the place x0. It has a momentum p0, and then it moves in the potential and sometime follows a path through it follows a path and it ends up at another place with a different momentum at a later time. Now, classically, when h bar is equal to zero, we can know both the position and the momentum, but quantum mechanically, of course, this is not allowed. So the quantum mechanical situation is just a little bit different. Okay, so at the initial time, we can't specify the momentum anymore if we specify the position, and at the final time, if we measure the position, then we can't measure the momentum. So if we work in terms of positions, what we're left with is an amplitude, a quantum mechanical amplitude, for a particle to, at time t0, be at a place x0, and to end up at a later time t1 at a place x1. Okay. And the path which it follows between these two events, if you like, it is not totally determined. In fact, all paths are possible, and this is encoded in the Feynman path integral, which is a way of calculating quantum mechanical amplitudes, which is slightly different from, you know, what we first teach undergraduates in terms of solving Schrodinger equations and so on. The Feynman path integral gives you a sort of direct representation of the amplitude for this process, in terms of the paths which take you from the first event to the final event. And what the path integral says is that you should sum over all of the intermediate paths, and each of them gets some weight, which is a phase factor. And the phase factor is computed by looking at what is actually the action of the path. Okay, so instead of having a single classical path, we have a sum over all possible paths, and this sum builds up with all of these phase factors to give you the quantum mechanical amplitude for the process. Now, out of this, you can actually recover classical physics, because if you take h bar to zero, then the integral has to be dominated by the stationary point of the integrand in the exponential. So if you have a classical path, right, and you add a small amount to it, you can compute the variation around the classical path of the action. And this is something actually you did when you calculated equations of motion using the variational principle or the principle of least action in classical mechanics. And if you go through this calculation, it's just a very short number of steps. We won't do it in detail here, but you can pick it up from the slides afterwards. You end up with the classical equation of motion, which is the mx double dot is minus the gradient of the potential, which is Newton's law. So this Feynman path integral formulation is completely consistent with what you know about classical physics and the h bar goes to zero limit. Okay. Now we can use this formulation now to move on and try to understand something about field theory. So Now, the archetypal quantum field theory is quantum electrodynamics. That's the theory of electrons and positrons interacting with the electromagnetic field. And Here, the situation is slightly different. Now, space and time are a framework within which the action takes place. And at the time T0, there is a configuration of the field. So the electric field takes some form. That's our E0, which is a function of X. There are also some fields which describe the matter, the electrons and the positrons. And then you let this system evolve, and at some time T1 later, the field has evolved, the electric field has evolved to E1, and the matter fields have evolved to something which I've called Psi1. So now, and of course, in classical electromagnetism or classical mechanics, what you would do is you get some bunch of differential equations, which you would solve, which would tell you how the fields evolved over time. But instead, in quantum mechanics, what we have to do is calculate this amplitude for starting with a field configuration at T0 and ending up with a different field configuration at T1. Okay. So that's the basic quantum mechanical object in a quantum field theory. Now, and I just want to remind you about something to do with electromagnetism, which is that you'll recall that you write the magnetic field, which is a measurable quantity, as the curl of the vector potential, which is vector A. And you can write the electric field as minus the gradient of the potential. Now, actually, there's another term there, which is the time derivative of the vector potential. And this can all be encapsulated in one object, which is called the field strength tensor, which is F mu nu. And F mu nu has an expression in terms of the four vector potential. Okay. Now, the important thing to realize is that F mu nu contains E fields and B fields and is something which is directly measurable, whereas actually the four vector potential, you can't measure it directly. Okay. All of these things have four components because there's a time and three space components if we're in regular four dimensional space time. So these things behave well under Lorentz transformations. They transform what's known as covariantly under Lorentz transformations. So they're the easy objects to write Lorentz invariant theories from. They have this property that under gauge invariance, so you can shift the vector potential by a total derivative. So that means d mu means differentiating with respect to each x, and what happens is that F mu nu doesn't change, so the physics doesn't change. Okay. So now we're in a situation where we can write down by mimicking the classical case the Feynman path integral, and so now we integrate over intermediate field configurations. Okay, and again there's some phase factor, which is now a quite complicated looking action. But it's got bits in it which contain the electric and magnetic fields. That's the F mu nu term. And it has other bits in it which contain the matter fields, which is the rest of this expression. If you compute what happens when H bar goes to zero, you do this stationary point calculation again. It's rather more complicated than in the particle case. But actually, it gives you Maxwell's equations. So the inhomogeneous Maxwell's equation is that d mu of F mu nu is equal to the current. So the charge and the current are sources of electromagnetic field. Okay, so that's what happens if H bar goes to zero. If H bar is not zero, then this gives us the famous quantum electrodynamics. Okay, and in principle, you can start from this formula here, for the Feynman path integral. You can compute any amplitude you like in terms of the electric charge, the mass of the matter fields. The photon, of course, is massless, and Planck's constant. In practice, of course, it's very hard work, and there's a whole industry which has done this over many years. But the outcome, the basic outcome is very interesting. So what you find is that you can, if you take a couple of measurable quantities, I've just called them A and B here, and you do a quantum electrodynamics calculation, then there's one extra element that you have to feed into the calculation, which is some ultra, which is some scale capital lambda. And the reason for that is that you find that there are ultraviolet divergences in the calculations that you do. But you feed, once you've fed this scale in, you can extract from your measurements A and B values for the mass of the electron and for the electromagnetic fine structure constant alpha em. H bar, by the way, is kind of fixed. You define in modern metrology, H bar is defined to be a certain value. Okay. And then you can take these numbers, M and alpha, and you feed them into another QED calculation, put the scale in again. And what you end up with is you predict the outcome for another process, C. Okay. And the interesting thing is that actually, when you've done this, you realize that you can relate what your prediction for the measurable C is entirely back to the measurables for A and B using your QED calculations. And this scale parameter lambda that you put in the intermediate steps disappears. Okay. And that's because QED is a renormalizable theory. So it has this remarkable property that it predicts unambiguous relationships between measurables. And the expansion in alpha electromagnetic, which is roughly 1 over 137, so it's a fairly small number, this works spectacularly well. Right? And probably the best demonstration of this is the anomalous magnetic dipole moment of the electron. Right? So according to Dirac's relativistic wave equation, the magnetic dipole ratio of the electron is exactly 2. So the magnetic dipole moment of the electron is exactly 2 Bohr magnetons. But there's a small deviation from this, which is generated by quantum mechanical effects. And you can measure this small deviation, and this is the result that you get. You can see it's spectacularly accurate. The number 28 is the error in the last two digits of the result, 73. And you can also calculate. You have to work very hard to calculate to this degree of accuracy. Okay, and these are calculations which have only been developed over very many years. But you can see that the agreement is spectacularly good. Okay, so quantum electrodynamics is a very powerful theory, and it's a very accurate theory. And it works extremely well. These are some of the most accurate measurements and calculations that are made. Okay, so that's field theory in a nutshell. Okay. Now, if we're going to talk about gravity, we better remind ourselves a little bit about general relativity. You already heard some of this from John in his talk. So the point is here that what are the really important ingredients? Well, we have a space M which has some fixed topology for a minute. Okay. And on that space there is a metric. So the degree of freedom which really matters is the distance between points. Okay? So you take a point x mu and a point x mu plus dx mu, which is quite close to it. And what matters is what's the real distance between these two points, or the proper distance, if we're talking rigorously. And that's determined by the metric, which is this object g mu nu. And g mu nu is in general dependent on where you are in the manifold. Now, some examples are the Euclidean plane is the easiest example, and that's flat. And you know that ds squared is just dx squared plus dy squared. Okay. Another example is the surface of the sphere, okay, which is most easily written down in polar coordinates. And there's a piece which is d theta squared and a piece which is d phi squared, but you see the component of d phi squared is not constant, okay? And k is basically the radius of the sphere. And then a final example is Minkowski space-time, okay? So now we're really talking about a proper interval. And that again is dt squared minus dx squared. And the metric for Minkowski space-time is often given the name eta mu nu, which we will come back to in a minute. Okay. Now, the point about this is that we can change coordinate systems, right? For example, you can change from Euclidean coordinates to plane polar coordinates on the Euclidean plane. And the coordinates of the two points A and B change, but the proper distance, which is actually just the geodesic distance in this case, between them doesn't. Okay. So there is actually hidden in all of this a reparameterization invariance, which is that you can change the coordinates, okay? And when you change the coordinates, the metric function changes, okay? But the distances between points are independent of that reparameterization. Now, proper distance is actually not the only independent frame independent characteristic of the space and the metric. Okay, there's another frame independent characteristic, which is the intrinsic curvature. Okay, so that's illustrated in the picture on the right hand side. You can see that if space is curved, so like that. Okay, there are two independent principal radii of curvature. So just think of a surface. Okay. And this is the curvature of the space is again independent of the coordinates. So for example, if you are looking on the surface of the sphere, right, it doesn't matter what sorts of coordinates you use to describe that surface, it's still curved. Okay. So the curvature of the Euclidean plane is of course zero because it's flat. The curvature of this spherical surface is just 1/radius². Okay, it's a product of the inverse principal radii. The curvature of Minkowski spacetime is again zero. Minkowski spacetime is flat. Okay. Now, so in this, g mu nu is the dynamical degree of freedom. It's sort of like the vector potential in electrodynamics. But the whole postulate of general relativity is that g mu nu is the dynamical degree of freedom, and the curvature of space-time is generated by mass and energy, and that leads to Einstein's equations, which we have written down here. And the important bit is that on the left-hand side we have r, we have the curvature. On the right-hand side we have the stuff that generates the curvature, which is the stress-energy tensor. And then we've also written down this other term. This is the cosmological term, which Einstein wasn't very happy about, but which there is no reason in general not to have in there. And one of the puzzles of nature is why the cosmological term is rather small. Why is this cosmological constant lambda? Sorry, this is a different quantity from our previous cutoff, previous scale. Why is the cosmological constant so small is one of the mysteries which modern physics still wrestles with. And capital G is just Newton's constant. Okay. So this is a very nice, neat way of writing things which are actually non-linear partial differential equations for the metric. Basically, all you have to do is specify the initial conditions and solve, right? Now, of course, that's easier said than done in practice for complicated situations, but nonetheless, you get excellent agreement with observation and with experiment. So how are we going to quantize gravity? What must be the basic ingredients? Well, the first basic ingredient has to be that the physical amplitudes that you talk about must be reparameterization invariant. If they're not reparameterization invariant, then they just turn out to be zero. And so they don't actually tell you anything. Okay. So this is a very easy reparameterization invariant physical amplitude. It's basically an amplitude that the universe exists for a proper time s. Okay, it starts at some event p zero and ends up at some event p one after a proper time s. Okay, and then the Feynman path integral, you might speculate, which gives us this amplitude, is basically a sum over all such metrics. Okay. So here I've written down a Feynman path integral, where I sum over all the metrics which have this characteristic. I've got some matter fields in there as well. Okay. And the hypothesis is that this Feynman partial integral will enable you to calculate this amplitude. Okay. Now, this part that we've written down here, this is called the Einstein-Hilbert action. If you take h bar to zero, the stationary point just gives you back Einstein's equations, which we wrote down on the previous slide. So again, the path integral gives us a h bar goes to zero limit, the classical field equations. These bits here, if I just sum over matter configurations and I just use the matter part in the phase, this basically gives me quantum field theory in a fixed background space time, which is part of what John was talking about in his lecture, where we have quantum electrons and quantum photons, but we have a classical background space time. Okay. But that's a very easy way of writing down something that could easily be very complicated. So what does this integral over the metrics mean? What do we mean when we are going to sum over all these interpolating metrics between two space-time events? Okay. So we're going to look at sort of two attempts at doing this. So the first attempt is to basically copy QED. Okay. And you do that combined with a perturbation expansion in Newton's constant. And you might think that, well, gravity is weak. So perhaps the way to think about this is that basically there are just sort of small wrinkles in space-time. And although the metric is a function of position, actually what it is it's a sum of two bits. It's a sum of something which is completely flat, which is just a Minkowski metric, and then this h mu nu, which gives us these small wrinkly oscillations. Okay. If you make that substitution for g mu in Einstein's equations, and we've just dropped the cosmological constant term here, okay, because in practice it's very small in this case. Okay, so then what you find is that these small oscillations h, they satisfy this equation in the middle, which is basically a wave equation. Okay, this tells you that the matter is the source of these small fluctuations, and this is essentially the equation which leads to gravitational waves, for example, being emitted by matter in some kind of motion. Okay, so that's what happens classically. If you do this quantum mechanically, and so you're now viewing this as a quantum field theory, then you need an analog of the fine structure constant. So in this sort of quantum general relativity theory that we're talking about, we need a dimensionless fine structure constant. And unfortunately, Newton's constant has dimension, okay? So the dimensionless object is actually Newton's constant times a scale squared and then divided by h bar. Now, all the time we're actually using units where the speed of light is set equal to one in all these calculations. So if that scale is the mass of the electron, then this alpha for general relativity is about 10 to the minus 46. So he's really rather small and certainly weak. Okay. But you should worry, because if you now set the scale to be about 10 to the 22 times the mass of the electron or so, then alpha will be about one. Okay. Now that seems like a very large energy scale, but it's not really a very large energy scale. 10 to the 22 times the mass of the electron is only about 10 to the minus 8 kilograms. So this looks like there might be a problem, and in fact there is a problem. Okay. The problem is that if you start taking measurables and you start doing field theory calculations and you feed in your scale, and you try to deduce what alpha is and all the other parameters, what you find is that the parameters cascade, okay? And you can never take the outcomes of a number of measurements and feed them into a calculation and predict another measurement. And this is basically the statement that this theory we're talking about is not renormalizable. Now, actually proving it's not renormalizable is a tour de force, and the famous theoretical physicist Tini Veltman, who died this week, was an important figure in that endeavor. But actually, it's not totally dead. You can keep your scale and just work in a regime where it's small, and that's called effective field theory. And you can learn a lot about the relationship between quantum versions of gravity and classical gravity in that way. But it's not a self-contained fundamental theory of everything, because you have to keep this rather small scale in there. The other way of other route is that string theory actually contains this field H mu, this what is in fact a sort of kind of like a spin two field. And it also contains a consistent minimum distance scale. And it is a way of constructing a consistent quantum field theory of gravity. And Fernando will talk about that soon. But of course you pay a price. And the price you pay is that string theory doesn't just contain gravity, it contains lots of other degrees of freedom as well. So the question is, you know, can we do something else? Is there some other way of looking at this problem? So this is the second possibility that I'm going to talk about very briefly. Okay. So in the first way of looking at it, we just looked at fluctuations around a Minkowski metric. But there isn't really any particularly good reason to think that that's the case, okay? I mean, why aren't all metrics sort of, you know, equal in the eyes of the universe? Okay. So if we think about metric democracy, okay, then I've drawn a metric which is very uneven and higgledy-piggledy, which nonetheless connects these two space-time points. So there's a manifold which is higgledy-piggledy. Okay. It's worth bearing in mind, by the way, that the path integral, even in the particle case, okay, includes particle trajectories which are not smooth. Okay, it doesn't just include smooth trajectories, it includes all possible very, very spiky higgledy-piggledy trajectories. Okay, so there's one, there's another, there's another. Yeah, and the path integral will be the sum over all of these potentially very higgledy-piggledy spaces, which have the sole common characteristic that they have these two events separated by a fixed proper distance. Okay, but then if you have metric democracy, you should worry about, well, why wouldn't you have topology democracy? Why should you just consider spaces of one particular topology? Surely you should allow the topology to change as well. Okay, so once you allow the topology to change, okay, all kinds of complicated things can appear. So you can get wormholes, so little branches of the universe which split off and then rejoin later, for example. You can get big splits, big joins, okay. So there's a huge number of possibilities. And this is really very tough, because if you look at four-dimensional manifolds, you try to do this in four dimensions, they're only partially charted territory. And in fact, this is an extremely hard problem. So to finish with, what we're going to do is just look at a toy model to give you a very simple flavor of how these things might work. So what you're supposed to do is you're supposed to consider a graph of equilateral triangles, okay? And you imagine that the minimum distance between two points on your triangulation, that's denoted in red on this picture, which is just three edges. You imagine that this is actually the geodesic distance, okay? And then you look at the configurations of triangles. If you have a threefold vertex and you make all of these triangles equilateral, right, then you can't put this on a plane, it sticks up. It's a tetrahedron, okay, and that's an approximation of a place of positive curvature. If you have exactly six of them joining, on the other hand, then you can put them flat on the plane. That's a place of zero curvature. If you have seven, then you get a place of negative curvature, because if you put, like in the drawing, if you put five of them, you make flat, then the other two, with the last two, will stick up like this. Okay. So the idea is, firstly, fix the topology for a minute. Okay, so for example, you draw these graphs on a sphere. Then you sum over all possible triangulations. And because summing over all possible triangulations sums over all possible geodesic distances, that's a bit like integrating over all possible metrics. Okay, so then you sum, and then finally you sum over the genus. So the end result is that the amplitude in this case is a sum over triangulations of something which is a sum over genus. So the simplest one is a sphere. The next most complicated one is a torus. Then you get a double torus and so on. And you just have these two points which you keep at fixed graph distance, fixed geodesic distance as denoted by the red line. Okay. So this is actually a toy model which has given great entertainment to theoretical physicists over a long time, and to this day contains interesting stuff which is not properly understood. But of course, it's basically two-dimensional. It's not four-dimensional, and the reason why it works is because we understand geometry in two dimensions and manifolds in two dimensions and topology in two dimensions very well. So what do our universities look like if we do that? Well, the most interesting characteristic is that if you ask the question, well, how much universe is there in a volume which is inside a fixed distance S0? Okay. And the answer is it's S0 to the fourth. But if you were on a flat space, it would be S0 squared. Yeah. So actually the spaces that you get in this model are a long, long way from being a flat two-dimensional space. Okay. And that's really the message of this. Once you let quantum gravity out of the bag, all right, then it's very naive to expect that you will get spaces which are nice and simple and flat and look very friendly. Okay, and in fact, it's extraordinarily non-trivial that the quantum universe is so very four-dimensional, both locally and globally. And this is ultimately something that we will have to understand when we understand quantum gravity in a complete way. Okay, so we'll leave it there. Thank you very much.